This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast. Your, yes, I have to admit I'm a failed music critic and don't listen to jazz nearly as much as I should. And this is my annual comeuppance of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. I'm your humbled host this week. It is the end of 2017. Well, probably perhaps the beginning of 2018 when you are hearing this. And we are going to talk this week about the year that just passed in jazz music, both sonically and also politically. And this is a great opportunity for me to shut up and not talk very much because I have to be honest and say that I don't pay nearly as enough attention to this as I should. However, I am blessed to be joined by two people who I know pay a lot of attention, and who I trust implicitly. Sitting across from me, covers jazz in the New York Times, it's Gio Russinello.
What's up?
To my right, Natalie Weiner, who works for Bleacher Report, but still listens to more jazz than most of you lames. Most of you lames can't touch it.
I do what I can.
Gio and Natalie are here. I don't want to be so self-centered and say, but hope to educate me, and by turn educate a bunch of our listeners about what's been going on this year. I can only assume as dedicated podcast listeners that you guys are reading their work. However, if you haven't, this is a great opportunity to catch up. We opened with Micaiah McRaven. Now, of the records that I listened to this year, I really, really enjoyed this one. Gio, can you tell us a little bit about this album and also the city from which it comes?
Micaiah McRaven is a drummer. He's from Chicago, which is the font of like a whole wave of new and interesting expression when it comes to improvised music and a sort of sense of free rein given to the musicians. He recorded this album, which is called Highly Rare, and was first released just as a cassette tape. Forgive him for that.
Like in a cool way.
Like in a painfully cool way.
No, it was good. He's hip. It was recorded to tape, too.
It was recorded to tape, and that actually is part of what's amazing about it. It sounds rich and murky and analogy. But he's been doing this thing where he convenes a group of musicians that are not any kind of fixed group, but are usually from whatever city he's playing in. And he just kind of immerses himself in the vibe with these musicians. He's done it in London. He did it here in New York City. I caught that show at a random basement in Ridgewood, and it was insane. And he did it with musicians from his hometown of Chicago.
Is that where jazz is popping? Is it popping in Ridgewood?
Apparently, there's one spot.
It's a serious question.
That's the thing is, like, it's no longer surprising now that, like, jazz is popping in the places where the other music is popping. Like, it's back into it. Like, it's in the soil again.
So I have to go to Ridgewood.
You got
to
get there, man.
No, you don't have to go to Ridgewood. This is New York City. There's jazz on, like, every other corner.
Okay, fine. I'm just saying. I also hello to all my friends who live in Ridgewood.
Go pay him a visit.
You can have a jazz trip.
Hey, anyone I know who lives in Ridgewood, if you want to go see jazz in 2018.
As far as I know, there are not actually dedicated jazz venues. Are there?
Hollow is like not a dedicated jazz venue, but it's got plenty of like skronking, wild, out there improvisers playing crazy stuff once in a while.
All right, so 2018, skronking Ridgewood. DM me, holler at me.
So Micaiah McRaven, this fabulous drummer, composer, producer.
Older, younger?
Beat maker. He's younger. He's probably in his 30s.
God bless you for saying that's younger.
In jazz, it's younger.
Yes,
it certainly is. Yeah. He came out with a great record, I guess, last year.
It was in 2015.
It was the end of 2015, I think. And then he followed it with this one, which is highly rare. Anyway, it's just, it captures the sense of musicians making discoveries together in a space, and it captures like the shared context that all these cats in Chicago have. What I like about the way that Micaiah McRaven is doing this is that, like, it's super site-specific expression. It's, like, very much about the live contingency of, like, okay, we're improvising in this room together. It's only going to happen once. We're going to go for it. And then he's also got another angle on it, which is that he takes the tape, which is on, I guess, a four-track, and he splices, mixes, remasters, and also adds pieces to it. Mm-hmm. So he'll cut, and he'll do, like, a Tio Macero, Miles Davis cut-and-splice thing. So he's got, like, the frisson and the energy of, like, this live thing that happened. And then he's got the post-production and the producer's mind of a contemporary musician.
And I found that, like, sort of looking at some of the other Chicago records that you drew out when we were preparing for this, that was not an uncommon technique. Mm. Like, he's doing that. And then Jamie Branch also did something similar.
Right.
And then Nicole Mitchell, that wasn't quite the same, but she did record it live.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
So it's like, and I love that because I've always loved live jazz records more than others, you know, because I just think when the studio is so sterile, it really takes away from kind of how a dynamic, you know, when you go to jazz shows and you're like, this is the best thing in the world. You know, there's just nothing better than sitting in the room and hearing the musicians. And the energy, the conversation between the audience and the musicians is so amazing.
Right.
And, like, when people can kind of capture that on record, like, it's so great. And Micaiah definitely did that. Like,
yeah.
I loved this. It's just, it's a really unique aesthetic for jazz in 2017. Like, the kind of, like we said with the analog stuff, it's so gritty and it's just, like, very kind of groovy and funky. Like, I want to hear it in the club, you know? Like, I want to, like, go out and, like, dance to Micaiah McRaven. Like, I would 100% do that.
Right.
I think of the stuff that you guys recommended that I listened to, that I managed to listen to, and I think this happened last year as well, the things that probably grabbed me the most were textural things. And I felt like this record of all the things that you got was the most texturally alive.
Yes.
I found it hard to not listen closely to it.
Totally.
And that's a challenge that I have. Certainly on my side of the world, I find it very easy to tune out any number of predictable gestures, predictable sound ranges, et cetera. I find that always, it's easy. You can categorize it as soon as you hear it.
Absolutely.
And texture is often a very disruptive thing. And I felt like, I remember last year, was it the Wadada Leo Smith?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I remember feeling very strongly about the textures of those records. And I felt in a different way, similarly strongly about the texture of this album.
Absolutely. I think, like, first of all, the fact that it's just, I think, two horns, a bassist, and a drummer on this record is startling because it feels rich and it feels thick and it feels like there's
very thick,
like multiple viscous fluids that are just like being poured together and mixed. And
that,
like,
makes it sound gross.
Yeah, that was a poor choice.
Cut. Rewind. So
just let that one go. You know,
no,
just let that one
come right back
in. Fluid flow.
Yeah,
but. No, I basically what it is like what Natalie's talking about, I think, with the live, like the appeal of the live thing. Jazz plays an important role nowadays for listeners in terms of reminding us, like, maybe how to do some deep listening. You know, shout out to the late Pauline Oliveros. Like, how do you get all the way inside the music in a time when, you know, we've got overload, we've got low grade listening, we've got music that's sort of playing a lot of roles in our lives beyond just being something to really center yourself into.
The playlistification of pop.
See,
and
for sure.
Sensor.
I have a whole other beef with that whole, I don't know how much of a tangent we want to get.
Go
on.
Let's go.
I feel speak
like
on it. Speak
the
on it.
Radio has always played this role.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and
yeah.
So I think the shift is not, maybe not as dramatic as everyone has always said. There, omnipresent music is not new. You know, like I don't think that that's, you know, this has been present for a long time in stores, cars, whatever.
Interesting.
That's my personal take on that. But yes, jazz does encourage sort of focused listening. But for me, almost like the Micaiah, the fact that it's so kind of funky, I'm going to keep saying this word, it ties it to like this electronic
music.
Okay,
you can call it viscous.
I'm not going to call it viscous. No. I don't want to do that. It ties into this, like, electronic music jazz intersection that's happening in, like, a whole other corner, but obviously is very Chicago, you know, given that, like, house music history there.
Exactly.
But, like, Shigeto and, you know, Jalen Jalen. I don't know how to say her name. But they kind of incredible. They have jazz sensibilities that they're using in electronic music. And Bakaya, I think, has some electronic music sensibilities that he's using in jazz. Obviously, right. These are arbitrary distinctions, but...
But it's cool to think about jazz's contribution to other musics as being something other than like, oh, some swing rhythm or, oh, right. a walking bass. No, actually, it's mm-hmm. rawness, it's texture, it's like mm-hmm. conditionality, like contingency, like... That can inform house music too.
Is there
post-house, whatever,
or I would presume there is, but I might be wrong, a connection with this particular generation of Chicago jazz music and kind of earlier generations of what was happening in Chicago and jazz, which I know some about but not loads
certainly,
about.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Passing the microphone to Gio.
Okay, no, talk about that through line.
Fred Anderson was an elder of the jazz scene who died a few years ago and was a mentor to many people on the scene.
So a literal inheritance.
There's not a literal inheritance.
Not a geospatial inheritance, no. But an actual inheritance.
There is a true inheritance, and it comes through, you know, people of various generations. And one of the main figures who's carried that inheritance on and is, like, very intentional about it is Nicole Mitchell, who mm-hmm. had my favorite album of the year.
Let's listen to something off that album. Which song should we listen to?
Dance of Many Hands is a great, really melodic piece from this album, Mandorla Awakening to Emerging Worlds.
Okay, so let's listen to a little Nicole Mitchell. Take us through a little bit about Nicole Mitchell.
So she's somebody who apprenticed essentially with a wide range of these elders who are many of them now passed on, mm-hmm. one of whom is the aforementioned Fred Anderson, mm-hmm. and another is Muhal Richard Abrams, whom we lost this year, and whom Nicole Mitchell actually wrote a really beautiful reflection on for The Wire mm-hmm. magazine. And the Chicago scene, to me, is important in these times, especially because it's like an example of a relatively closely bound but free community that's like site-specific and as a result like allows musicians to kind of build together in a way that you can only really do when you have a certain dependability of place, like a certain yep. ability to like really root yourself down. New York is increasingly hostile to that, obviously. I was at a concert recently that I wrote about featuring these three bands from the downtown scene in the 80s. And what struck me, and this isn't downtown New York, what struck me is that like these bands had an intimacy and a commonality in terms of what they were going for, and also a sense that they were all going to be supported in a certain way simply because they were able to stick around where they were, make their music with a certain dependability of, mm-hmm. of audience, of you know, their peers being there.
Not getting priced out of the rent.
Not having to leave their studio or their home, or not feeling like, oh, this venue will probably be gone in 2 months. Mm-hmm. Chicago is I don't know the place intimately enough to really speak in great detail about it, but it's definitely not subject to the same kind of forces that New York is. And there's a long history from the AACM, the Association right. for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, on down. There's a long history of musicians doing for themselves in a variety of ways. Creating their own performance opportunities, creating their own opportunities to interact with youth, pass the music on, creating the opportunities to share their compositions mm-hmm. and move way outside of any imposed tradition, really kind of create their own.
Can I ask sort of an amateur question? Because I feel like I remember a similar thread coming up say, 3 years ago about Los Angeles and sort of like the early Kamasi kind of coming into the world era and all the musicians around him, and then how that ended up kind of seeping into kind of Kendrick and et cetera. And I wonder, are there similar conditions at play in the LA of 2011, 12, 13 and the Chicago of 2016, 2017?
The sort of vibrant local scene makes good on national stage is like a recurring theme. Right. And, you know, it's like Chicago was bubbling under for a long time, right? And we're kind of seeing a lot of these musicians hit the mainstream. And LA was bubbling under for a long time, and we see them hit the mainstream. It's like sort of the natural way that trends go, you know? Everybody kind of hits the jackpot a little bit at once. Mm-hmm. I think in LA, the reasons for the like seeming surge in talent were more because the city is friendly to musicians in a different way because there's so many opportunities for studio gigs.
Yes.
And there's just a lot of money. Like the pop music like industry there allows jazz musicians to make a living and also to make, you know, there's space. Like Kamasi, I know, recorded a lot in his home studio, and you know, there is that kind of room and space to create, but it is subsidized by the pop music industry. I think my sense in Chicago is there's just a deeper avant-garde tradition, you know, the AACM and the history there of sort of passing on this, like, we're really going to be countercultural, you know, and this is an important tradition that we need to continue to pass on. And Nicole Mitchell was the first woman to be president of the AACM, right?
Right.
And so she's kind of a revolutionary in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And it's great to see her kind of getting her due, as it were, because she's been hustling for a long time. But so I think it's like definitely similar ideas as far as like scene, and like I think it's really beneficial. I brought up the London scene too in my email.
Take the note. Don't apologize. Take that swing. Talk to us about Chewbacca and kind of everything that's been happening.
I mean, I feel like before we totally depart from Chicago, we need to mention Jamie Branch.
Yeah.
Definitely. Right?
Okay, let's listen to Jamie Branch.
Yeah. Okay.
What song?
I think Theme Nothing is like one of the best from that record.
Great.
I'm in.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
I, like, am not as familiar with her as Gio is, but just listening to this record, it's like she has a really interesting story as somebody who's older and putting out her first solo album, or like album as a band leader is the right word, really.
But, now 30s is older in the context of this conversation.
Well, I don't know.
Are they SoundCloud rappers? Jesus.
Okay, but older.
No, but you're right. She's been out there.
Debut album.
You're absolutely right. She's been out there.
Come
for
on.
Like.
No. She's getting me back for the viscous liquid thing. Anyway.
Eschkenaz.
15 years on the scene. That's a long time. You're right.
Yeah. And so she's like played with all these varying people, different genres, all kinds of stuff. And she came to New York and started like hosting these jam sessions, as I understand it, in Greenpoint. And it kind of created the foundations for this album, which is a mix, as we were talking about before, of like live recording and then stuff that she added to it and edited and all this other stuff. And it's just, it's really short, right? It's like 35 minutes total, mm-hmm. I think. And it's just so decisive and really clear. Like the ideas in it are so well thought out. You know, I feel like a lot of jazz musicians, like they write their stuff and they're like, well, this is my composition and this is my art. And they'll go on at length. And it's just kind of like, all right, you need some editing. You know,
yeah.
She doesn't need any editing.
Right.
Like she edited before she put out the record, which
right.
is what you want,
right.
you know, because like to really communicate your ideas effectively in this music when it's so abstract, like you need to be tight. You need to like be really clear about what you want to say. And she did that. And it's just like, it's a great record. And it's really, you just want to sit there and you just listen to it from front to back. And you're like, okay, I know what she's about.
Yeah, I got nothing. Do you want to switch now to talk about London a little bit?
Sure.
So explain a little bit about Chewbacca Hutchings and the scene.
I love that we have like this international jazz scene that's like concentrated. It's like it's international because it's in London, but it's also international because London is a hub for people from so many different countries, you
yes.
know, like people from Africa, people from the Caribbean, people from the Middle East. And it's just like Chewbacca Hutchings, he put out an album last year that made a lot of waves and kind of started to cross over into these same sorts of, I guess, alternative R&B jazz intersecting scenes that we see with like Thundercat and Kamasi and whatever. Like he was reaching the same people that like that stuff. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so.
And he, like the Chicago people we're talking about, he kind of became the star of this scene in London that is really like his drummer, Moses Boyd, is also like really an extraordinary mm-hmm. talent. And like the interesting thing about London, I think, is there's just so many women who are like emerging from it and like young women who it doesn't seem to me if they were stateside would necessarily have the opportunity to record. This is just my kind of sense of it. And I drew out Yaz Ahmed as one that we should listen
you
to.
You mentioned a bunch. You mentioned Zara McFarlane, Yaz Ahmed, Camilla George.
Yeah, and Nubia Garcia. I like her album a lot, too. And it's like they're all kind of a lot. Moses Boyd is involved in a lot of them. Chewbacca's involved in a lot of them. It's clear that everybody's kind of like hanging out together. Like you see the through line. You see the network and the web, which is just like it's interesting to see that develop. And Giles Peterson is obviously kind of instrumental. He is the one who like plucks people out and decides who will be good and who will
woke
you know.
Tim Westwood. So you want to listen to something off the Yaz Ahmed record?
Yes, it is called The Lost Pearl.
Lost Pearl, Yaz Ahmed. Thank you. Tell us a little bit about this song.
Yaz is a trumpet player. She's from Bahrain, but she lives in London. And this is her second album. But it's just like a very sort of, I don't know. It's like good vibe music. You know, it's definitely kind of like low key, like ambiance, but it's really deep. You know, she brings in a lot of sort of Middle Eastern influences. Like on this song, there's finger cymbals, there's Doombeck, but it's not in such a way that it's like really cloying. You know, it's clearly just like one tool in the toolbox. And her trumpet sound is very sort of Miles on Bitches Brew-esque. Like she's adopting that like reverb and stuff, but it sounds unique. And she's created a recipe for a sound that's totally her own. You know, it's like a little bit new, like vibey, groovy, contemporary jazz, but it has this Middle Eastern flair, and it has like Shabaka Hutchings is playing bass clarinet on it, you know, and like
fire instrument.
Right.
Shout out to my man Jeff Pirajot, who used to rock the bass clarinet in high school band.
I was wondering where this is going.
Shout out to Jimmy Kimmel.
She's just like, and she wrote earlier, like we have, I don't know, before we started talking, we were talking about gender issues, but she was one of the many people who responded to the whole like Robert Glasper fracas that happened earlier this year.
We're gonna get in on that.
But yeah, so she's a woman, she's a band leader, but most of all, she's just a great trumpet player.
Can I ask sort of a rude question?
Yes.
Okay, so
does it have to do with viscous liquids?
Does not. Well. Okay, so I lived in London in 97, 98, and 99, and this is just after the sort of what I think felt very gauche at the time, which was sort of the acid jazz moment. So, and acid jazz being sort of trip hop adjacent, but kind of like the aggravating parts of it without the fun parts of it.
Yeah.
But I think I always felt like when I was
new jazz and you jazz.
Yes.
Bad news. Right. Bad news jazz.
Straight No Chaser magazine, like all that stuff. Uh-huh. Shouts to all my British journalist friends in the late 90s who were out there trying to get me into new jazz. Didn't happen.
Keep trying.
Yes. Good luck to y'all. Shouts to Galliano and all that, you know. But I remember at the time thinking that this feels, you don't want to dismiss an entire category of music, but there was something that felt kind of fundamentally, it didn't seem like it could happen in America. Mm-hmm. There was something slightly distanced about it and its relationship to groove that felt
inorganic,
brittle almost. Yeah. Hmm. But also in that same way that it felt like it couldn't have happened in America, it did feel very particular to a lot of my experiences with British interactions with Black American music.
Hmm. Black America's music. So yes, like Caribbean music
is the influence there. And I wonder if, just to hear you guys talk about, you obviously listen to way more of this generation's music than I have, but I wonder if some of the kind of syncretism that's happening in that scene, it has anything in common with what was going on around acid and new jazz in the mid-90s.
I do think so. I mean, I think a lot of the musicians that we hear in the British jazz scene right now, like for instance, Shabaka Hutchings' other group, The Comet Is Coming, or Moses Boyd's group, Exodus, that you mentioned, or like Native Dancer, although they're less this way. But those bands have a relationship to groove and to sort of bassy, dance-driven ideas that are less about Robert Glasper and more about jungle or more about drum and bass or post-drum and bass. And they're essentially like a corollary to what's going on here, but they're not really driven by the sounds or the concepts of the United States, except maybe in the sense that like you might see somebody like Robert Glasper getting big with a kind of crossover and say, oh, okay, it can happen. Or maybe Giles Peterson, who really is sort of like...
And that's what inspired me to ask the question, because I remember him being such an arbiter of this music at the time period when I lived in London.
To me, I understand the criticism, definitely, obviously, of acid jazz. But for me, I feel like it feels while it doesn't necessarily, it feels dissimilar to American music in the way that you're insinuating. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's a strong thing. You know, like, I think that's a good thing that they're finding their own.
Right. I sort of came like, around identity, to it. Right. Because I was originally looking at it coming from New York and sort of like hearing it in relationship to what I knew. And it took 2 years of being there, being like, oh, it's.
What it is,
the other way.
Yeah, what it is like the people who end up there, right? That's number one, is like most of the jazz innovations that have happened in Britain over the past 50 years have come in some way from the Caribbean.
Right.
Exactly. Or other colonies, but mostly from the Caribbean.
I mean, like when I went to see Skepta with Gio this summer, or Skepta, oh my God, I'm like giving away my cell here. When I went to see Chewbacca, not Skepta. but he was doing this like, shut up.
Men's not hot.
my brain isn't working. That's fine. When we went to see Chewbacca, like he was doing this really extended groove, like crazy thing and just like soloing up the wazoo. But there was a part that sounded like Shut Down. Like it sounded like he was doing the beat to Shut Down, like this guy on the tuba. And I was like, this sounds like grime. And it makes so much sense because obviously they're probably like going to parties where they're like listening to grime or whatever. But it's like you see that it's like specifically there, just like the and that's the benefit of the local scene that we were talking about.
Exactly. That's what I was sort of, that's the other half of what I was thinking right now is that like, yes, it's about the Caribbean and about the places where people's musical heritage comes from. It's also about the relationship to live music that is specific to a city. Like we were talking about Chicago or we were talking about LA. Like in London, there is more of a live music culture than there is in the United States.
Yeah.
And it has to do with those kinds of music. And you like see these musicians playing instruments being driven to elicit a certain response from the audience that they've seen from DJs doing, you know, doing jungle MCs doing grime or whatever it is. And they're saying, okay, like, we're actually trying to, like, make the pot boil in the same way.
Right.
And I think that's, I think probably my awakening in that time period was the thing that I didn't understand at the time when I first moved there was how primary the nightclub was as a sort of site of engagement.
Totally.
I sort of understood, like, hip-hop shows, but not, like, and there are clubs.
Like
but like, a hip-hop club is different than, like, a club that's playing, like, Sasha and Digweed or something like that. And so
we can learn from that.
Here. Yeah, I was surprised. I think then it took a while for me to, like, reorient my listening around that. So basically what you guys are saying is acid jazz has come back in 2018.
That was the takeaway.
That's, okay. So
what I do want to open on to
is there, like a fire acid jazz? Like, is there, are people not doing acid jazz revival right now?
There's no such thing. Let's not even give nobody new ideas, man.
Podcast at nytimes.com. Send me your SoundCloud. Send me your Bandcamps. I want to hear all the acid jazz revival.
I feel like what
Gio, we're sending you to one for the acid jazz revival.
Hey man, give me your expense account. I'll go.
I'll go to London. If there's an acid jazz scene and revival in London, holler at me and we'll talk about it.
I think the bigger conversation that is pending or we're about to really have to have or is going to ultimately be on the brain in the years that we're sort of stepping into is like, where does this music live? Like, what is the live experience of jazz in 2017, 2018? Because like performing arts centers and jazz festivals are like a bit more abundant at this point. Like they're where the music lives, but the music is now starting to go like back to its roots and back to the city soil where it's really born. And
city soil.
Those
or
places.
I'm sorry.
Another word.
Yeah, city soil. That's poetic way of saying asphalt.
I'm sorry.
So basically the idea is like if the music is not being born from a certain community element or a certain like site, then where it's performed matters, you know, and jazz clubs are also kind of on the outs in terms of being tied in a really humane, intrinsic way to like the source of the music. Like that's no longer like
where
it's invented. And the jazz club is beautiful and feels important and real because there is an entire kind of jazz that was built there. And like that is the soil where bebop was born. So
or the asphalt.
That was the
or the wood floors.
Well, yes, right. The creaky oak.
No, but this is the thing I was thinking about because, like, as we're surveying the jazz of 2017, and it's kind of like a conversation that we were all having at the beginning of the year was about La La Land, right? Like,
oh my God.
This was like.
Was that this year?
It was end of 2016.
Oh my God, end of 2016. It feels like 100 years
but
ago.
But it's like If you look at the survey of what we're talking about, of just the music we've discussed so far, and you look at that movie, it could not look more out of touch. The whole idea behind it, I don't know what Damien Chazelle is thinking, because it's like it takes literally 3 seconds to discover like a bajillion exciting young artists who are doing new cool things in places you wouldn't expect.
Are you telling me that my screenplay that I've been working on for years about a middle-aged white guy that opens up a hip-hop club so that Big Daddy Kane can perform and Kool Moe Dee can perform is not...
I think that would be great. Are you going to star, write, and direct?
I should can that is what you're saying. No. Oh, my God.
But you see what I – it's just like that whole idea that jazz is dying and jazz must be protected. And I see this theme all over. Everyone's like, listen to more jazz. Listen to more – like, and this is a theme that people keep repeating. It's like everybody's here. Everybody's doing it.
Yes.
You know, they don't need to be taught. Right. It's like this is – it's happening whether you like it or not.
Right. We just have to make sure that, like, the means of conveyance and the means of access to the music don't, like, stay so off the ground and separated from the music itself that people lose their interest in it.
Right.
This reminds me just a little bit of something that you wrote in one of your pieces to CRGO, talking about kind of, like, the post-repertory stage that we're in.
And that was probably the Monk piece, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So one of the things that piece was about was how here we are in a year of all these centennials, but also these centennials – maybe don't matter in the way that even if they had happened 5 years ago.
Yes.
So get into that a little
totally.
Bit.
All right. Ella Fitzgerald, Dizzy Gillespie, Buddy Rich, and last but very much not least, Thelonious Monk all had their 100th birthdays this year. And the jazz world, like, kind of gave it up for Monk in a certain way. The others kind of just flew by, and like we didn't even see him vanishing in the rear view. Like, we didn't even really pay attention to those dates. And even the Monk thing, there was like a level of discomfort with like going too hard on focusing on Monk, partly because, yeah, he's a guy who helped invent bebop. Thelonious Monk helped kind of establish the canon of repertoire that everybody who wants to be a jazz musician feels obligated to learn. But we're now operating in a time when the onus on musicians is less to learn the old stuff and more to make something new. And there's always going to be like a push and pull because of jazz's, you know, venerated space in American culture and the fact that we associate it with an important time, a time of optimism, a time of civil rights activism, a time of like progress in the country. And I think that's really the hidden reason why people are so nostalgic about old school jazz is that it was a moment of like recognizing black genius in a way that the country was never comfortable with before. And so it
represents, at least retroactively, maybe was not recognized so much in its own time.
It wasn't, but it was done in an ugly way in a lot of cases. Like the way that it was written about was super problematic and white supremacist in certain ways, but it was still like a certain new entity to have Charlie Parker, you know, saying I'm going to play to people sitting and listening to me, to have Miles Davis turning his back on the audience and people putting up with it in their own way, you know, griping and grousing, whatever. All I'm saying is jazz is like, is a certain cultural entity, and we keep trying to go back to what it was giving us then. So that's going to keep happening. But now the music is re-engaged.
Yeah.
And as a result, there's less focus on Learn the Monk tunes. And it was really interesting to see these 100th anniversaries go by and the point basically being on, okay, cool, thanks. Let's look at this in the context of like a completely different landscape, not in the context of like, oh, we're still trying to get to like Monk's genius. You know?
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe a sign that we've moved past the Wynton Marsalis like neoclassical era once and for all. You know?
Early.
Like,
and we were just talking about this before we started turning the tape recorder on, right? Was like even straight ahead jazz musicians now sound like experimental jazz musicians. Great example, I think, is somebody who may or may not really be legitimately called a straight-ahead jazz musician. But Vijay Iyer, you know, has a trio, a longtime trio, that by all appearances would seem like a pretty standard jazz trio. They play some Ellington tunes. They swing sometimes, even. They came out with, his sextet, not his trio, came out with an album that topped the NPR Critics poll, was all over everybody.
As with most Vijay Iyer projects, it received almost universal critical acclaim, and with reason.
See you!
So I'll should notice. We listen to...
Yes, Into Action, Vijay Iyer Sextet. So universal acclaim or near universal acclaim.
Yes.
That's a problem that happens in a lot of genres.
Right. I think with jazz, it's like the people who we find that with, it's Vijay, it's Jason Moran, Steve Lehman.
Sure.
Like those are probably the three, I think.
There's some dissenters on Steve Lehman because his alto sound is so hard to listen to sometimes, but I love him.
I love the shade.
No, not shady.
I mean, like, he's on the Vijay record.
It should be. Let me just qualify that. It should be difficult to listen to some things.
Okay.
It's really, really powerful.
Yeah.
It's just like some people are not ready.
Okay, well, we can at least agree on Vijay and Jason.
We can agree on
it's
Vijay
like
and Jason.
Everything they put out. Everybody loves. They are the reigning jazz people. And they have institutional credibility, basically. They have both institutional mm-hmm. credibility and, you know,
I know we got a Kendrick dissenter over here. But
I'm a realist.
But so Vijay put out this album, Far From Over,
uh-huh.
and it is ostensibly political, as
right.
we're discussing, music that is engaged with
yes.
the present. It's great. I mean, it's a bunch of people that he's been playing with for a really long time. Tyshawn Sorey, whose album we also wanted to touch on, I mm-hmm. know, also another very critically acclaimed one, great drummer and everything else. And Steve is on the record and other people. It's Stephen
Graham
Crump
Haynes.
Is Graham Stephon Haynes.
Crump is on
Stephon
there.
Stephon Crump.
Graham Haynes is a fabulous trumpeter who doesn't get enough acclaim.
Yeah.
And made a huge impact on me through this record, for sure.
It's just like they've been playing together forever. And Vijay wrote this music for the Ojai Festival,
mm-hmm.
and they premiered it there, I guess. But the album is just cool. It's, like, really funky and fun and, like, exciting to listen to, I think. And I first heard the music at Newport. Did they play it there? Yes. I feel like I've heard
yes,
it, like, seven times. But, yes, definitely at Newport. And I was just, like, grooving. You know,
was
I was,
a
like,
lot
dancing.
Of energy at that Newport show.
Yeah.
There was a lot of, like, whoa, what just hit us? And there
yeah.
was, yeah.
It's surprising from him. I mean, like, he usually sort of works within the bounds of the contemporary jazz vernacular, I guess. And this felt to me like him experimenting a little bit more with some stuff that was closer to pop. Definitely not pop, but it had some of those beats. It had some of those sound, like things for people to grab onto.
Although
you know?
He's one of the handful of jazz musicians with a sick Human Nature cover. Just going to throw that
sure,
out there.
Sure. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like his compositions in general,
absolutely.
They sound away, which is good and they're great and people love them. But this mm-hmm. felt like a departure to me.
Yeah.
Before we started recording, we were talking about that re-engagement
mm-hmm.
and through not just politics, but also speaking, like
mm-hmm.
actual words. And Gio, I remember in your roundup of the live shows of the year, you talked about a Matana Roberts show that you saw where there were interruptions basically in the show talking and she would speak about, you know, surviving life in the Trump era and so on and so forth.
Right.
And I was
actually in the article I wrote about women's rising role.
Sorry,
in music,
my bad. My bad.
Yeah, I was there.
yeah. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that, because even before we started running tape, both of you had come up with a bunch of examples of places where this was happening this year.
Yeah. Montana Roberts is
I mispronounced your name. My bad.
It's understandable.
No.
Montana Roberts' way of constructing her solo shows involves opening up conversations, inviting the audience to engage in ways that are rather non-traditional for a transactional, I'm here to hear some music kind of thing, right? But yeah, it relates, I think, to the broader sense that like this music ought to be dealt with in a liberated fashion and in a fashion that involves like placing it in a kind of social conversation around like, okay, I'm going to tell you about where this music is from. I'm going to tell you what really motivated me to make it. And I'm going to actually allow for some naming of the thing, you know, because part of jazz's power is that it forces us to imagine a lot of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
It forces us to superimpose a lot because it's instrumental largely, because it's abstract. And then there's the other thing, which is that it comes from a certain, it's like profoundly personal music because it's improvised, because it's rather open-ended in terms of what you can do. The genre is by now completely wide open. And as a result, like there's a lot of ineffability, but there's also a lot of conversation that you can have around, okay, where the heck is this thing that I'm trying to express coming from? So some of the great jazz records this year did have words on them. Flesh and Bone by Mike Reed involved Marvin Tate, who's a really amazing poet from, I believe, Chicago, which is where Mike Reed's from.
I thought you were saying involved Flesh and Bone from Bone Thugs and Harmony.
That would have been even better. I want to hear Flesh and Bone on a jazz band.
I'm just saying, just want to throw that out there for a future.
You know, I have Flesh and Bone's email. His email is Flesh and Bone. Well, I won't say
his email. Don't put his email. Don't put his email.
Okay, well, that wasn't his email.
I mean, we're not that popular, but like, still, I don't want his
email. Well, I know his email. His email is hilarious.
Okay, so just for the record, if anybody needs Flesh and Bone's email, Natalie has it. I do have Natalie. Okay.
So then there was one by Jane Ira Bloom dealing with. She's a fabulous soprano saxophonist dealing with Emily Dickinson's poetry. Which is a little different from the kind of a hyper-contemporary conversation we're talking about, but feels in some ways related to this. Yep. Nicole Mitchell's record has vocals on it, not a poet per se, but a mix of spoken word and semi-operatic vocals that express some pretty serious sentiments. And yeah, it's just something that we saw all over the jazz world.
I feel like this is the moment to pivot into talking about some of the vocalists, because it was a great year for vocalists. Okay. You know, and I don't
convince
know.
Convince me.
Convinced? Okay. Well, just I know before when we were discussing poetry on records, you know, and on stuff, I brought up Jasmia Horn, who I was just kind of catching up with, and we both saw, you were at that show, right? The Brick Jazz Fest one?
Oh, no, I was at her show at Dizzy's.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, we both saw her this
year.
Same set, I think. And I'm sure, I imagine Gios feels the same way. I was like spellbound by her show. She won the Thelonious Monk jazz competition a couple years ago. And her presentation is very much like jazz Erykah Badu. Not that Erykah Badu is not jazz Erykah Badu, but just in the discussion of poetry, Jasmia on her record, which I feel like is a little inconsistent and doesn't quite show everything she can do live. I don't know if you felt the same way. It was nominated for a Grammy, so not everybody agrees with me, but just seeing her live show, it was so dynamic and incredible, and she has this amazing, really powerful engagement with, like, what she's doing and with the audience. I was amazed. But there is a track on the album, and it's a cover of Afro Blue, but she merges it with her own poetry, like, about basically civil rights and Black Lives Matter and sort of the oppression of Black people, you know, a very relevant theme always. And then she finishes with Wade in the Water. And it's like a 15-minute track that she just kind of – and it's really incredible. And she, like, uses all corners of her voice. But she's also doing some spoken word poetry stuff, which also ties back to the Erykah Badu comparison.
There's a deep history there, right? I mean,
right.
It goes back to Oscar Brown Jr. and Abby Lincoln. And through people like Erykah Badu, who will take a long time to, like, get their point across through spoken word or
storytelling. Like, it makes me happy to see these vocalists who are, like, choosing to stretch the boundaries of what jazz vocalists are supposed to do. And Jasmia Horn, I think, is a great example of that. Gio brought up Liz Wright, who I know you really liked her album this year.
Album.
John really liked it, too.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Well, Liz Wright is just somebody who, she mostly was covering other people's music on this album, although she likes to play her own tunes as well. I think this was more of a tribute to the repertoire of, like, kind of the American South writ large.
But it's still kind of like coming at jazz vocals with like a really strong point of view. I feel like coming at it with a thesis as opposed to being like, let me play some standards, you know.
Beautiful.
And I feel like
totally.
Jasmia is doing that. Liz is doing that. I wanted to bring up Cecile, and I know you have feelings about her, but Cecile McLaurin-Salvant is probably the most critically acclaimed jazz vocalist out right now.
Yeah. Should we listen to some?
Yeah.
What song should we listen to?
Mad About the Boy.
Mad about the boy. It's pretty funny, but I'm mad about the boy. He has a gay appeal that makes me feel there may be something sad about the boy. Walking down the street, his eyes look out at me from people that I meet. I can't believe it's true, but when I'm blue, in some strange way, I'm glad about the boy. I'm hardly sentimental. love isn't so sublime. I've got to pay my rental.
So with Cecile, what she's kind of created a niche doing is really being very selective about the American songbook. Like, she's a scholar of it. Like, she's not just like playing standards. Like, she is entrenched in both the more well-known songs from it and like some really deep cuts that like nobody's heard since 1930. You know, she like pulls out these things and finds songs that are very specifically resonant with today and performs them in such a way that they feel totally fresh, I think. And I picked this one to hear because it's like, it's a standard, like Dinah Washington saying it, but she makes it sound so haunting, you know, like she arranges it in a totally different way. Like, it sounds like a new song. That's her thing that she does. Like, we saw her in Newport and she did Sophisticated Lady, which is like, you know, the most by the book, like every vocalist sings that song, but it's just like, it felt like a gut punch. I was like, I've never heard anyone sing it this way. And it's about her choices in arranging. It's about the fact that she's just an incredible singer with a whole lot of control. But she has a very clear idea of what she wants to say with her performance. And that just comes through.
And there's a misanthropy to the way that she sings.
Definitely.
And there's like a hostility to the material that's really important.
She comes at it with a critical eye. And I think that that's like, she does this song called Wives and Lovers, which is like the scariest song that you can hear.
They're all scary songs. Sophisticated Lady is a terrifyingly misogynistic song, as well as being like somewhat compassionate, you know?
But it's like, that's her, I think she's just doing such an amazing thing. Like, and, it, you know, it comes back to this thing, and I know we're maybe going to talk about sexism, but like, jazz vocalists are still never taken seriously as artists. They're just not. They're viewed in a separate conversation, you know? And Cecile is one of those people. She needs to be in the middle of the conversation. Esperanza Spalding is another one. They should be central. Like, Esperanza should be in the Vijay Jason Moran category of, like, she is one of the best we have, like, one of the most consistent artists we have. And because she sings, she gets pushed off to the side. And Cecile is just, like, I think, yes, it is traditional. She is a standard bearer. She is a historian as a musician, but I think she does it in such a way that she's not recreating something that's already happened. She's retranslating it in a new way.
And also, and not to step over you, but I think, you know, talking about repertoire before, and I know there's a larger conversation we're about to embark upon about the role of women in jazz and sexism in this particular tormented and tortured year. So it's interesting to hear you talk, Gio, earlier about how this was a year in which we largely said to the jazz canon, like, we're good. Like, we're good with that. But here's a great example of someone who's like, actually, I want to engage with it, but I want to engage with it in sort of a fundamentally different way than others have.
She's making the lives of other jazz vocalists more difficult in a way that's really good and important and going to actually lead to, in an ideal situation, a new way of taking jazz vocalists seriously, like you're talking about. We can compare and contrast, not to be a hater, but we can compare and contrast to Gregory Porter, who did a Nat King Cole album with a bunch of strings and a really good jazz trio, and he sang the Nat King Cole songs.
Right.
That's what happened.
Another thing I wanted to talk about, commercially successful jazz, that was one of the best-selling jazz albums of the year, you know?
The Nat King Cole record. Because it said Nat King Cole on it, and it was Gregory Porter. And
it's Gregory Porter. People love Gregory Porter. Yeah. He does
Hat God.
Yes, Hat God, you know, inscrutable Hat God, Gregory Porter. But he, you know, he does the thing that people want to hear the way they want to hear it. He, by all accounts, enjoys doing it. I can't really be mad at that.
No.
But, like, it's a different way of looking at the American Songbook. And I love the American Songbook. But
you mean,
like,
Cecile's way.
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
But
yes.
Like, I just think there's so much there. Like, the point of jazz, the reason jazz started engaging with the American Songbook in the first place was there was so much to unpack. They were like, there's so much here that we can deal with.
Nice.
You know, that we can, like, recontextualize or challenge or, like, put in a whole different way. Like, John Coltrane can do My Favorite Things and make it sound like a scary, crazy thing. You know?
Yeah,
like,
precisely.
I don't know.
I'm really gratified that over the course of the conversation, we've talked about so many female jazz performers and vocalists. And I'm especially glad that we did that in a year that has not been without some issues and some trauma around that very subject. So just for context, this is something both you guys have written about. But for context, there was a thing that happened earlier this year. Ethan Iverson, who is a performer but also runs a blog. And
no, well, now he writes for The New Yorker. He's moved up in the world. But, I'm just saying.
So anyway, he's a blog. He blogs for The New Yorker. Published an interview with Robert Glasper. And Robert Glasper, as men are occasionally do, only rarely.
Yeah, very, very
super
rarely.
Super rarely. Said that he knew what women wanted.
Yeah.
From jazz.
Well, yeah.
Maybe in other capacities, but he said he knew, and he said something I almost don't even want to say it because I found it
it's pretty hard to say.
It's just like, it's like, check yourself, bro. Like, just don't. Anyway, you can Google it. You want to find out, just Google it.
He said that he knows how to touch the musical clitoris of his listeners.
Yeah. Well, and he also
Pedro,
said,
can we bleep that?
I think probably more importantly, he said that women don't like long solos.
Yes.
And he said that women only like things that have a groove to them and blah, blah, blah. And it's less that he said it, you know, like, because whatever. I'm not going to talk about it because I don't want to incriminate myself. But anyway, it was more the response. The legions of people defending what he said online was just like, what? Like, it was just, it was kind of surreal, but it really exposed.
Shouts to all you homebound jazz fans defending Robert Glasper on the internet.
Well,
right?
No, but it was actually like very prominent jazz musicians as well. Like the discourse, it was like
a lot
of musicians, like a lot of fellow musicians being like, blah, 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 you know, whatever. And it was interesting for me to see, like, as somebody who's been entrenched in this music for more than a decade, like, it's like, oh, we're finally having this conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, like, mm-hmm. This is not something that I've felt like we've ever been allowed to talk about, you know? And it's just kind of interesting that it just took that one thing and suddenly everything snapped. And now this is like a real conversation mm-hmm. that we can have. And like, certainly there's
a context around that one thing happening, though.
Right. There's a history of women in jazz, certainly,
and,
you know,
like,
but
the whole like rising up of like these kinds of conversations in other cultural spheres too.
Sure, but yes. He definitely provided a tipping point.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
If he hadn't said that, if he hadn't said that, we might not have ever talked about it. And then later in the year, what came up is women who, actually it wasn't that much later, it was like 6 months later, there was a story about sexual harassment and discrimination at the New School among female jazz musicians. Mm-hmm. Like, just a student paper did the story, and I didn't see it until like 3 months later, but they reported it really thoroughly and were just like, yeah, all the girls, women who are studying jazz at our conservatory feel, you know, like they're being discriminated against, like, and they don't get the same opportunities.
There was also the issue at the Berklee College of Music.
Right? Yep, yes. And that came out later. That was kind of more in the post-Weinstein debacle.
That they had sort of quietly let go of a number of faculty members.
Yes, who had sexually harassed or assaulted students.
Mm-hmm.
And that's now a thing that people are looking at all these other conservatories.
And these are the these are supposed to be the safe space. I mean, everywhere.
Right. These are the institutions.
Space,
you know, this isn't even like going out to the club and whatever happens there. As somebody who has been a 22-year-old girl going to jazz clubs in New York by herself, you know, it's like you see there's a whole other realm there. But this is like inside the institution. This is inside the conservatory. So to know that that's not even a quote unquote safe space, as so many conservatives are wont to call them. But yeah, so it's just started this whole other conversation. But the great thing is that we've organically already been talking about the music of so many women this year. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel forced. You know, like they've just been part of the conversation, which I think is an important
Do you think
step.
That women have always been out there making this music and that a lot of it is the fact that the voices talking about the music aren't as interested in them or haven't been as interested in them?
Definitely. I mean, there's all the gatekeepers are men.
Yeah.
You know, like not just media, but record labels, mm-hmm. whatever,
club
studio
bookers.
People, club. It's like every person in power is a man, you know? So it's like most women, I think, have often given up. The ones who don't, you know, keep plugging away and they make their music and they never quite get the same credit for it, even when they're as famous as Esperanza Spalding. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, it's just kind of, there's a double standard that's been in place for a really long time.
What you're talking about, Natalie, reminds me of something that came up in your interview with Esperanza this year, which was and you're going to have to give me the names, but there was a performance that she did with two other
Jerry Allen and Terry Lynn Carrington.
Yes. And talking about, I forget the exact word that Esperanza used, but that she was doing this thing in other performance spaces where she was blocked off, in essence.
Yeah.
She was bracing herself. Bracing.
She did use the word, which I thought was a good.
Great word. She was like,
I realized that I'd spent so much time bracing, you know, like just trying to predict the reactions of the men around me and trying to like censor myself as to not upset them. And Esperanza works with men all the time. You know, this is clearly not like a deal breaker for her.
Robert Glasper.
Right, was in the video. Yeah, it's like, so this
I'd like to know, did they have a live conversation during those 77 hours about Robert Glasper's idea
well,
about gender?
Well, he wasn't in the whole time. He just walked in and out.
I don't know. I feel like that's kind of the first question when you show up.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other thing, but I mean, certainly a conversation you hope she's having with somebody. But
I remember being very moved by that particular segment of that conversation.
Well, and I was like, I almost didn't bring it up with her because it's like, I know women jazz musicians do not like to be asked about being women jazz musicians. That is perceived rightly as insulting. It's like when somebody is like, what's it like being a woman writer? It's like, well, whatever. But like, I had such a special experience at this concert. I was like so moved by what I heard. And part of that was just seeing that there were only women on stage. And the music I felt had a different energy to it. Not like a woman specific energy, but it just was unlike anything I had heard before. So I brought that up to her and she was like, yeah, it is a different energy. Like it felt freeing, you know, to be able to play with just women. It's not that like women have a way of sounding, you know, right. It's just that they are allowed to express themselves as musicians or feel like they are more liberated to express themselves fully. It's like, it's a nuanced thing and it's hard to totally predict.
Right,
she put it very well, outside
of the context of potential sexualization and all this other stuff, like to exist
and just like
free
being
of that.
Underestimated and all the other things that you're sort of constantly grappling with when you're in a male dominated environment. And they're just like, no, we've created this space where we don't have to deal with that. I mean, when I spoke with Esperanza about it, she was optimistic. She was like, she said they hadn't talked about sexism a lot when they were in this trio, but she was basically like, Jerry experienced it more than Terry, and Terry experienced it more than me, you know? And she was like, you know, she felt that it was a thing that was falling away, you know? And it's like, these are the conversations we have to have to continue that process. Jerry Allen, we should note, is an important person who passed away this year in the jazz world, untimely.
Yeah, huge loss. Jerry Allen being the piano player in that trio you're mentioning and a mentor to so many people. And in the same way as Nicole Mitchell, sort of, we were talking about earlier, forms a bond between generations and like admits to her own personal canon so many different kinds of music and so many different kinds of expression. And passes that along in her own way. Jerry Allen did that like almost nobody else, like the amount of information she was able to take in and then disseminate through her own teaching, being one of the first major jazz musicians to have a postgraduate degree at a time when that was just not really even done, and then to be an ethnomusicologist as well as an expert practitioner, as well as a composer who got Cecil Taylor's free jazz as much as she got Herbie Hancock's post-bop, like, Jerry Allen is an insanely important figure in jazz. And unfortunately, she was not recognized as much as she needed to be.
Exactly. And she was one of very few women even to get critical. You know, and even saying she was underrated, like she still got more critical acclaim than like most of the other women who were her contemporaries.
Let's go out with something by Jerry Allen. What do you guys want to hear?
This is an original tune, LWB's House, The Remix. It's from an album of hers called The Life of a Song with Jack DeJohnette on drums and Dave Holland on bass.
Jerry Allen, R.I.P. Thank you. Before we go out with all the credits, I want to put out a call for questions for the Ashley Simpson podcast, which is going to happen, and it's going to happen soon. So email us at podcast@nytimes.com.
It's about her jazz album, right?
I bet that
about
would,
time.
I bet that's right. I bet it'd be Fuego.
Well, you know that Thundercat used to play bass for Jessica Simpson. Just putting that little tidbit out there.
And y'all thought I was doing a non sequitur.
Jessica Simpson is related to Ashley Simpson.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. I knew
Thundercat
it was all
is related to jazz. All the things are related.
It all comes together and falls apart at the
so
same time.
So we're going to be talking about Thundercat on the Ashley Simpson podcast. That's our show this week, the 2017 Year in Jazz podcast. Incredibly edifying. I hope everybody has a reading and listening list to follow up on. Thank you to my guests, Natalie Weiner and Gio Rusinello. I appreciate your guys' expertise and patience with a knowledgeless host. I'm very grateful for that. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us. Hell, email me, not just about the Acid Jazz Revival, but any interesting jazz-related subjects that I might be curious about at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere you subscribe to audio content, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, etc., etc. iHeartRadio app, if that's a thing that a person uses. I believe we're on there too. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We're back next week.